This is the Financial Sense News Hour. Now, here's the Financial Sense News Team, Jim Poplava and Chris Prytower.
Welcome to The Big Picture. I'm Chris Prytower, and on today's program, we're going to pick up on a theme echoed in the first hour with Craig Johnson, and we want to expand on that. In fact, as Craig said in the first hour, he thought the S&P 500 would be in a narrow trading range this year with a low of 2,500, all up to a high of 2,900, which is just about where we are right now. But that the year-end expectation of 2,750, 5%, lower from where we are now. Now, that's not the market consensus. The consensus is for even higher stock prices, ranging from 2,900 to 3,000 by year end. The other consensus is that the Fed will be lowering interest rates by late fall, with the possibility of 1 to 2 rate cuts by year end. So there is a lot of bullishness out there that the markets have come roaring back this year. And Jim, as you and Craig have discussed, and really we've covered this in previous programs, there's nothing that has changed here fundamentally that would justify the comeback in stocks this year, other than the Fed and the ECB's pivot on their hawkish stance on interest rates. But as you pointed out recently, several of the issues that would cause major damage to the economy, those issues tend to have receded from the Mueller report, clearing the president to the reversal and pivot by the Fed on interest rates. So this does leave only the trade war with China remaining, and there seems to be some good news here echoed by Vice President Pence.
Immediately on China, remember, this is the definitive hawk on China. He gave the speech at the Hudson Institute that we have all said was the declaration of a new Cold War, yet he wasn't as hawkish here, which to me is a signal the administration's working on a deal, wants a deal. He doesn't want to derail that. He doesn't want to get off message. That's a signal to the market that full speed ahead, they're trying at least.
So it seems like at the moment that we've managed to dodge a bullet. The question remains, for how long?
You know, if the world was at risk of sliding into a recession, you know, what we have seen, policymakers appeared to have moved in time to prevent it, at least at the moment. Recently, we got a better print on the ISM manufacturing report. China's PMI index rose in March, but that's only 1 month. And we also saw a modest improvement in Germany's industrial production. So for at least the moment, the panic that gripped the financial markets last year has receded. Now, a lot of the global slowdown stems from China, and there is hope, and here's the big one, this trade deal solves that issue. So the hope is that the U.S. and the global economy picks up steam during the second half of the year, especially if this trade deal emerges. But there are two new risks I want to bring up that are emerging, and a possible third one that could be possible. Risk number one, a spike or shock in oil prices. We're looking at close to $65 oil on WTI, $70 on Brent. Another possibility, what if the growth in the economy is stronger than expected? What if it accelerates in the second quarter and third quarter as it did last year? And as it usually does, it picks up our strongest quarters of the year are in second and third quarter. Now, you combine, let's say, stronger growth with the possibility of higher oil prices, would the Fed remain on pause or would they begin to change their tune again? Remember, these guys flip-flop. And number three, if the economy weakens considerably, there is no stimulus with a contentious Congress. Where would it come from? What would it be? It couldn't be an executive order. That's not going to do much. And it certainly looks like Congress is in no mood to cooperate with this president. So if it does slow down, what would that leave? It would leave only the Federal Reserve.
Well, don't you think this could go really either way, Jim? I mean, the economy improves or it slows down even more than it has now. What do you think would be the implications if either of those happen for the markets?
Well, let's begin with a big risk that I see as more probable, which is a spike or run-up in oil prices. We are currently at close to $65 a barrel. And Chris, you and I have seen this here in California. Gas prices have gone up nearly a dollar a gallon. So the higher oil prices are now, it's acting as a tax on consumers as we head into this summer's important driving season.
Well, why do you feel this is a risk? And many of our technicians are not bullish on the sector as much as you and Dan Steffens are.
You know what? We're entering a seasonal time of the year where transportation fuels normally increase. I mean, as the weather warms up, people take vacations, they get in their RVs, they go across the country. But here are some simple facts. The EIA just released a report that the demand for oil-based products will increase roughly about 1.5 million barrels per day in the second half of the year. That was backed up in addition by a report by the IEA, which is reporting that demand for oil will exceed supply by 500,000 barrels per day starting this quarter. And to make matters worse, there are geopolitical situations that are already starting to impact production figures. Let's talk about them. OPEC oil output just dipped to a four-year low, dropping by 500,000 barrels last month. That's the lowest level we've seen since February of 2015. Saudi Arabia is following through with its commitments to cut deeper than they pledge. Saudi production dropped by a massive 324,000 barrels in February. They're now down below 9.8 million barrels. When you were considering at the peak last summer, they were producing almost 11 million barrels. So the OPEC cuts are holding. Now, let's add another factor into the equation, which is Venezuela. The country basically is falling apart, which is leading to a steep drop-off in production. Give me an example. Last month, the country experienced massive blackouts. Production has now fallen below 1 million barrels a day. With the steepest plunge last month, their production of oil dropped by almost 290,000 barrels to 732,000 barrels. Now think about it. 2 years ago, this was a country that was producing nearly 2 million barrels a day. Elsewhere, Iraq, the cartel's second biggest producer, slashed its production by 126,000 barrels. And you also have the problems in other countries like Libya, Nigeria, and Algeria. And the other factor has been a negative for oil is American shale production. Turns out, shale production numbers reported monthly have been less than reported by nearly 100,000 barrels beginning in January. The other factor, production growth is decelerating. There have been several articles on oilprice.com and some in the Wall Street Journal that talks about a lot of these shale producers outside the big guys that are moving in are having to run faster and faster. And that's because shale wells usually peak within their first year of production. So when you add all this up, the oil market is tightening as a result of growing demand. You've got OPEC cuts that are greater than planned, especially with Saudi Arabia cutting even more. And then you also have falling production figures in what we call the Fragile Five, which is Libya, Nigeria, Iraq, Algeria, and Venezuela.
I mean, if the Saudis are determined to stay the course on their production cuts and OPEC rolls this thing over and we don't have any big macro scare, I think we will likely go higher, yes.
So the Saudis are driving it predominantly?
This has been a Saudi story. I mean, the Saudis were the ones last summer because President Trump basically said, I'm taking Iranian barrels off the market. You surge production. The Saudis did a million extra barrels. They've rolled it back and then some. I mean, Saudi Arabia is 400,000 barrels below their OPEC quota. They have massively reversed course on production. And importantly, they have slashed exports to the United States, the most visible market. So they own the Motiva refinery. They're sending no barrels to that refinery in Texas.
So, Jim, with all that's going on with OPEC cutting production and demand increasing more than production, you can't help but support the price of oil. So what would be the implication here if oil prices rise to levels that were reached last year when WTI rose to as high as $76 a barrel?
You know, the first thing is that the level of inflation in the economy would start to rise as it did last year. I mean, think about it. You know, you're seeing it already at the pump. What does that mean? Every truck that brings goods to the store that you go to buy things, whether it's groceries or clothing, that's going to go up. Airline fares are going to go up. The cost of transporting goods, whether it's a train, plane, or automobile, it's going up. And as that happens, you could see bond yields rise along with it, as we saw last year. As prices headed up to about $75 a barrel, what did you see? The 10-year bond got up to 3.25. You also could start seeing Fed officials change what they say at FOMC meetings, hinting at possible further rate hikes. But that may be less of a risk, as higher oil prices will slow down the economy because, you think about it, It's acting as a tax on consumers. So the higher gasoline prices go, that hits the consumer's pocketbook. So all of the possible threats to the economy during the second half of the year, a possible oil shock would be the biggest one. I just don't see the Fed wanting to raise interest rates because of higher oil prices. I mean, you think about it. What could they do? There's nothing they could do to bring prices down other than basically kill the economy. You can just imagine what the presidential tweets would be if they were doing that. Also in the Fed minutes that were released this week on Wednesday, Fed officials see little reason to continue to raise rates due to the greater risk to the U.S. economy from global growth slowdown. So the Fed is starting to say, oh, wait a minute, what happens overseas that could come to our shores as well? The Fed minutes also show there is a greater unease over the downward drift in consumer and business expectations of future inflation, which plays a major role in determining price pressures. Remember, we barely got to the Fed's goal, stated goal of 2% last year, and then we fell below it. But remember, the way the Fed measures inflation is probably a little bit different than you and I experience as a household, which is probably higher. There's another factor that comes in here, Chris, that plays in. We are in a presidential election cycle. Next year will be a presidential election. Normally, you see the Fed go on hold during election years as they don't want to be seen as altering or trying to interfere in an election year. You saw the Yellen Fed, which were going to raise interest rates in 2016. If you notice what happened, they only raised rates once, and it was in December after the presidential election was over before they moved on to start raising rates. I suspect the Powell Fed will be no different, so if they need to make a move, either up or down, it will have to be in the second half of the year.
Well, let's go ahead and move on to some of the other possibilities. If either growth becomes too strong, or do you think it would continue to decelerate?
You know, the growth becoming too strong would be hard to see, as I just don't see the catalyst for that to happen. The government stimulus, this was the $300 billion that they passed in January of 2018, that runs out by the end of September. And I do not see the Democrats cooperating with the president on any legislation, as they are going to try and bog him down with all kinds of superfluous investigations. So I doubt if you're going to see any more fiscal stimulus before the elections. You can just imagine next year how silly things are going to get right before the election. The other stimulus that I could see is a trade deal that gets done with China. But that will help Europe and Asia more than it does here, because the U.S. is not as heavily dependent on exports as Europe and Asia. Some of that will rub off here, as Europe is a major trading partner of ours. But that being said, second quarter GDP should be better than the first quarter as a result of no government shutdown, and that was estimated to have knocked down about 0.5% off first quarter GDP. So second quarter GDP should improve over first quarter, and we will be getting first quarter GDP towards the end of this month, so we'll get a kind of first glance at what first quarter looked like. Everybody's expecting it's probably going to be closer to 1%. Now, if it does not improve in the second quarter or is less than, let's say, 2%, look for the Fed to start making mention of possible rate cuts, and which is what the futures market is now predicting. They're predicting anywhere from 1 to 2 rate cuts by the end of the year. Now, there's also the China trade deal, which the markets are placing so much hope in. But Chris, I don't see that as a big stimulus. Over the years, the Chinese are getting less bang for their stimulus efforts. And the reason for that is the economy has become more leveraged, and they haven't developed their consumer markets, with investments and exports really being the main drivers of their economy. It's interesting, there was an article in this week's Barron's, which was titled, What the U.S. Gets Wrong About China and Why This Spells Trouble. It was written by Chinese expert Michael Pettis. Without going into depth and covering everything in the article, according to Pettis, Chinese economic growth has peaked, just like Japan's did in the late 1980s. We were all worried by the end of the 1980s, there was this anti-Japanese sentiment. They were buying American real estate. Their economy was growing the fastest. And there was this feeling that Japan would take over the world. The Japanese market peaked in 1989, and it has not reached that level in 30 years. So Pettis, who has been on FS Insider numerous times, is saying, look, China's economy is peaking. An aging population, their one-child policy, enormous amounts of debt accumulation, and an underdeveloped consumer economy strewn with malinvestments make their economy vulnerable to much slower growth rates going forward rather than the torrid growth rates of the last decade.
Volatility is back. The stock markets are pivoting, the Federal Reserve is raising interest rates, and experts are predicting another recession. How will your retirement weather the storm? Are your investments fortified? Do you have a consistent source of income? Financial Sense Wealth Management can help you answer these questions and plan for the unpredictable. We monitor the markets, interest rates, and the economy so you can focus on doing the things you enjoy most. Contact Financial Sense Wealth Management at 888-486-3939. Start planning, stop worrying, and make the most of your retirement. Call 888-486-3939 today. Advisory services offered through Financial Sense Advisors, Inc., a registered investment advisor. Securities offered through Financial Sense Securities, Inc., member FINRA, SIPC. Both companies doing business as Financial Sense Wealth Management.
Well, with the distinct possibility, Jim, that the economy is more likely to slow down and continue to decelerate, and that's a theme echoed by two prominent FS Insider guests that we've had this week, former Barron's Roundtable member Felix Zuloff and Martin Armstrong. In fact, let's listen into their thoughts, which echo the ones here that are expressed on the show today.
The U.S. economy is soft. The expansion and the economic data will really be coming in next year. The hard landing we see is more outside the country rather than in. So just as you've seen in the first quarter, although the numbers kind of went down, the Dow rallied dramatically. This is all capital flows.
That was Martin Armstrong. And then here is Felix Zuloff.
Right now, the consensus believes the world economy is bottoming out. I think that is a little bit too early. I think there will be more negative surprises ahead into fall of this year or later this year, and that should lead to some sort of shock.
So those full interviews can be heard on our premium FS Insider channel. We do encourage our listeners to check those interviews out. Just go to financialsense.com and hit subscribe to listen off our site or any mobile device. But regardless of what happens to the economy going forward, whether it's a slowdown or an acceleration, which looks less as likely of a scenario, we'll know sooner or later, given the late business cycle, if we'll have another recession and bear market. So when that happens, what is going to be the policy response?
You know, as we've seen in Europe with negative interest rates, currently the next response, probably here and abroad, is going to be taken right out of the reflation playbook. That is why you're starting to see more talk about MMT, which is modern monetary theory. And as Craig Johnson and I discussed in hour one, the fact that interest rates on German bonds is negative as well as in Switzerland and Spain tells you how little firepower central banks have today. Now, the Fed does not have the same ammunition they had in the last recession when the Fed funds rate was at 5%. Now think about this for a minute. When it looked like the economy was going into recession, the Fed funds rate was over 5%. They brought it down to zero. And Chris, that still was not good enough to revitalize the economy. We had all the programs, the alphabet soup programs from TARP, and then they launched QE1. That didn't do it. Then they launched QE2. That didn't do it. Then they launched QE3. So that is why you're hearing the Fed talk about moving toward inflation targeting. Now this week, Fed Vice Chairman Richard Clarida said the central bank is looking at new ways to deal with low inflation as well as a novel approach to stimulate a weak economy and better ways to communicate that to the public. They have come to the realization, no kidding, that rates are likely to remain lower than the past, even during periods of economic growth as we saw last year. They are now considering how best to get inflation to hit their 2% target. MMT gives them the answer. It also fits with the political goals of not only the administration and politicians of both parties, Both parties are embracing this. And remember, unlike we were a decade ago, when we were running trillion-dollar deficits, I think the worst deficit was 2010, I think, when it got up to about $1.6 trillion. You notice now that the debt is heading towards $23 trillion, and it's going to be going up $1 trillion or more, and we're not even in a recession. Notice nobody is talking about the debt. Nobody is talking about the deficit. Instead, they're saying, hey, under MMT, we could just simply print as much money and issue as much debt as we want to because it's in our own currency. In fact, the government just reported this week, it ran a budget deficit from October to March of $691 billion. That's up from $600 billion during the same period last year. Now, the deficit was driven by an increase in spending, which rose 5% over the previous year. So the idea about the deficits are caused by tax cuts is not entirely true. Government spending, actual tax revenues were up several percent, but government spending is growing faster than revenues. Those deficits are now approaching $1 trillion. If we did $600 billion the first 6 months of the year, the government's fiscal year begins in October. This year, we are on track to approach $1 trillion or more. And, you know, the unemployment, think about this, the economy is still growing. The unemployment rate is the lowest it's been in almost four decades, or almost half a century. That deficit is going to be rising every year going forward and will only get worse during the next downturn. If we're running trillion-dollar deficits, what happens when the unemployment rate goes up to 5, 6, 7, or 8%? In a recession, revenues decline, government spending increases. So hence, you're seeing more and more calls for MMT. On the surface, my gut tells me this is something we discussed in the first hour with Craig. On and off the air, there's some kind of a shock lying out there that is yet to surface, just as we saw, for example, last February and last fall. We may see this surface on the earnings front. Maybe we get lower earnings for S&P 500 companies. You cannot have a decelerating economy and rising earnings outside financial engineering, let's say through stock buybacks. A slowing economy, what does that translate into? Translate into lower sales, lower profits for companies. And Wall Street is still too bullish, and lower earnings could be something that takes bulls by surprise. But plain and simple, it's just hard to find a catalyst that could drive this market higher other than program trading. I mean, this economic recovery has been fueled throughout this entire business cycle by a constant stream of stimulus, either coming from government fiscal policy, as we saw in 2009, as we saw in 2011, as we saw in 2018, or through central bank intervention with QE1, 2, and 3. Now, it's been global in nature, so it's not something that's just happening here. And it's also something we've never seen in history. When you think about it, and many of you that have been relying on interest-related investments know this better than anybody else, because you're living on that interest for income. And remember, up until probably the last 2 years, the interest at the bank, money market funds, CDs, was virtually almost zero. In fact, in 2016, if you put your money in T-bills, you actually lost money and you paid the government money. One of the most, when you take a look at this market, and some of our experts on the program have made this comment, it's probably been one of the more difficult economic recoveries to navigate. And the reason is so much of what happens in this economy and this market depends on government intervention, either on the fiscal side or from the Fed on the monetary side. And we've already seen, for example, just a couple of weeks ago, an inversion of the short end of the yield curve and a brief one on the long end. And we've had a handful of experts. They feel the Fed went too far last year in their aggressiveness to hike rates. They saw the stimulus. And if you looked at the stimulus, you know that that was going to be a pop in the short run. The question is, it would fade, and it was expected to fade over the long run. So why they got that aggressive, I don't know. But probably one of the main reasons is they want to get the chamber loaded with some bullets. In other words, they wanted to get the interest rates up high enough so if we did get into a downturn, they would have some ammunition by lowering interest rates to stimulate the economy. The problem that the Fed is having, and it's a problem the Bank of China is having, there's just too much debt in the economy. And so even though you lower interest rates, as they did on the long end and the short end, when you have so much debt, when your balance sheet is loaded with debt, there's only so much debt you're able to take on. So we hit the breaking point in December last year, in my opinion, and that's why you saw the abrupt change you did at the beginning of the year by the Fed. They realized quickly by what happened to the markets and the incoming economic data they had gone too far. But that is par for the course, as monetary policy usually acts with a lag in the economy. The markets always get it right, more often than not.
Well, Jim, let's bring this back to the rest of the year. You and several of the guests here on the program think there's a probability that the economy continues to weaken as we head into the second half of the year. So just like last week, are you still playing it defensively? Do you feel that recent data supports that view?
You know, Chris, we still are defensive because we think things like defensive stocks, bond proxies, are going to be the place to be during this period of time. But I also think you need to slowly start building a position for the next recovery cycle after the downturn, which in my opinion is going to be inflationary with MMT and the Fed already talking about inflation targeting. So they already know, given the tools that they have, they couldn't raise interest rates high enough. Let's put it this way. If they stop at where we are now at 2.5, that's half the rate they normally have raised rates in the past. Normally, when they are raising rates to slow the economy, they get the Fed funds rate to 5 and 6%. This time around, they only got it to 2.5. And also, it took 3 rounds of quantitative easing over a 4-year period to finally bring rates down and get the credit cycle moving again. So what are they going to do next time? Is lowering interest rates from 2.5 back down to 0, starting QE again after they've been shrinking their balance sheet? You know, what tools are they going to have? And that's why right now they're looking at various ways that they can stimulate the economy, because they know the kind of things they've used almost for half a century, which is basically raising and lowering the Fed funds rate, didn't work this last time around. It took QE. What is it going to take the next time?
So to sum up, we've added another new risk to the equation this week, which is a spike in oil prices. That really does zap consumer pocketbooks, and really it could lead to another spike in interest rates. But also, there's not enough evidence at the present time to definitely support acceleration in the economy. So defensive positioning is the strategy of the day. And Jim, what do you see coming up in the weeks ahead?
You know, a couple things coming up in the weeks ahead. We are now going to be entering Q1 earnings season, so it's going to be interesting to see what companies say about not only their first quarter profits, where the economy slowed down, but also what they're saying about the rest of the year. So we're going to be watching that. And we're also going to get our first print on GDP, which we know is going to be much lower because of the shutdown. So we're going to be watching some of the economic indicators. Will we see a pickup? Because remember, the ISM manufacturing report was trending down. We did get a pickup in the recent latest report for the month of March. So is that trend picking up? Because we'll be watching the second quarter. Will it be much stronger? Will growth pick up? Those questions are going to be answered in the next 3 months. In the meantime, on behalf of Chris Prytower and myself, we'd like to thank you for joining us here on the Financial Sense News Hour. Until you and I talk again, we hope you have a pleasant weekend.
The Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of the Financial Sense staff and do not take into account listener suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense News Hour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies mentioned in Financial Sense or arising out of the use of any material on the News Hour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.